The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Unsigned Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
In this episode, we spoke to David Keenan. We spoke remotely in mid-September and we had a good rambling chat about his approach to writing and some of his published work.
Yeah, I think he's someone who very much relies on his sort of instincts and faith in the writing, leading him where it needs to go rather than spending a good couple of years procrastinating in what we'd like to call research.
Yeah, it's quite different from a lot of the authors we've spoken to.
Absolutely, yeah. David is the author of This Is Memorial Device, which has an even longer sort of subtitle. This Is Memorial Device, an hallucinated oral history of the post-punk music scene in Airdrie, Coatbridge and environs, 1978 to 1986, For the Good Times, which he speaks quite a lot about in this, and most recently Extabeth, which is going to come out at the start of November. He also speaks about a couple of other books that he's got in the pipeline, so
do check this out. And in the meantime, here's episode 34, David Keenan.
Well, I didn't really know any writers, you know. I didn't really know anyone who wrote fiction, so I didn't really know how you did it, and I had no one to ask. I've never been to a creative writing workshop or anything like that. I did it the hard way by, I just thought, well, I'll sit down and I'll write a novel from start to finish. And I very quickly found out in the writing of that it was complete and utter garbage. It was absolutely awful. So, and I felt really dismayed, you know, when I was writing my first novel. I was like, I just don't have any idea how to do this. I've got no feel. This reads like the most cliched drivel of all time, every second-hand idea of what a bloody novel should read like. But then I realised that, well, this is where you're going to give up. This is where people give up. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to write hopelessly. So I decided I'm going to finish this worst novel of all time, this piece of absolute dreck. But I told myself that when I finished it, I would destroy it. I would ritually destroy it and start all over again. So I spent a year writing seriously the worst novel of all time. I mean, I remember parts of it and I want to crawl up and die, but I finished it. So I got all this crap out of my system about what a novel should be. And then, like, I not only deleted it from my laptop, I smashed my laptop to pieces with a hammer just to make sure it could never be retrieved. And also just to ritualize that. But more importantly, to prove to myself that I was writing for the right reasons. And in a way, what I wanted to do was I wanted to write hopelessly. Absolutely hopelessly, with no idea in mind of ever being able to write a book or ever being published or anything like that. And so after I destroyed that first book, I spent probably the best part of a decade writing novels every single night after work when I came home and just not submitting again and again and again. And that's how I basically taught myself to be a novelist, the hard way.
And what was the sort of impetus to start writing at all, writing as opposed to doing anything else? What sort of drove you to actually put pen to paper at all?
Gratitude, I would say. I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. And when I was growing up, I was born in the east end of Glasgow, but my parents moved to a small town called Airdrie outside Glasgow in the late 1970s. And you know, it's regarded as a kind of rough, like, working class town. And it was, of course it was. But I remember growing up there and just having the most magical time, the most magical experiences. I read this book called The Book of Airdrie. I actually knew one of the guys that compiled it, a guy called Mr. Scobie, a very eccentric old intellectual. And he could see that I was interested in books. Went to this primary school called Clarkston Primary. The headmaster was a guy called William Brown. Again, a very eccentric man in this strange town. And he could see that I was interested in reading and writing and stuff. And he was very encouraging. And he gave me this book called The Book of Airdrie. It came out in the 1950s. And it's an attempt to get the members of a borough to sort of give their own cultural, social, economic history of the place where they lived. And there was a section in it about ghosts and the supernatural. And this kind of blew my mind because I was like, fucking hell. You know, I'm into, like, I'm reading Lord of the Rings, you know, I'm into Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, stuff like that. And when I came across this section about ghosts in my own town, I began to realise that where I was completely magical. That where you are is the centre of the world. And I began to realise, wow, the place I live has supplies the kind of material with which you can write a book. And that kind of blew my mind. And I had such a really, despite growing up quite poor and in a rough town, I had such a, my childhood was so happy. It was absolute, it was a mini paradise. We ran wild the whole time. And so even at that time, I was conscious. I was like, I want to memorialize this. I'm so grateful for this experience. It's been so magical. I owe it to the universe that gifted me the experience to sort of memorialize the universe in return. The universe likes attention. You know, and spending the more attention you pay to it, the more it gives back. So I made a kind of vow as a child that one day I would write a book about Airdrie, about growing up in Airdrie, that was magical, positive, poetic, optimistic, affirmative, and reflected my true experience of that place. And the other thing that was a big influence on me as a kid and it made me want to write was my father's side of the family. My father's side of the family were all Republicans. They grew up in the Ardoyne in Belfast, and just as the Troubles broke out, my father left and moved to Scotland to marry my mum, but the rest of them stayed, and, you know, we'd have phone calls, or sometimes they would come over and stay. We had a little annex, a secret annex, a safe space for some of our uncles to stay in if they ever needed to escape Belfast for a little bit, and these guys were illiterate. These guys couldn't read or write, but they would guess how language worked if they had to write. So they say they would write you like a Christmas card or a birthday card, and like every word would have a comma after it. The spelling would be completely guessed at. But it was beautiful. It was fucking beautiful. And it was this fucking beautiful poetry and challenging, weird avant-garde poetry, like fucking Ezra Pound or something sometimes. And it would also be incredibly moving. I remember the birthday card that my father wrote for me before he died. Now, my dad never read any of my books. He wouldn't have been able anyway, but he never found out that I became an author, which is one thing I'm sad about. But in the last birthday card he wrote, always remember you are an very special person. And even just that, fucking that play with words, I loved that facility with language that these illiterate Irishmen had that betrayed a genuine faith in language because they were all about storytelling. But it wasn't really about the content of the story. It was the way, like Frank Carson, it was the way you tell it. So they would compete to be able to perform, really, the best story. And it was fucking amazing. And the best story would involve multiple jokes, probably a couple of song sections where somebody would sing, and then this ridiculous tale of something that happened to them or one of their pals that you would never be able to work out whether it was true or not. But it was just told so well. And for people who couldn't read or write, this incredible faith they had in language to transform their own reality. You know, one of the ways that my uncle survived the Troubles was through storytelling and language, was through the retelling of it, which somehow redeems it. So yet again, as a kid, I clocked when we'd be locked in with my uncle and, you know, he'd be smoking fags and he'd have all these rings on and they'd all dressed really sharp and they were all in a pericomo and they all smelled the cologne, they'd be combing their hair with a fag in their mouth and I'd be listening to these stories. And again, it came back to gratitude. I was like, I'm so grateful for these experiences, for these men whose relationship to language is modernist, really. It's like a sort of street modernism that they kind of had, which I would argue Irish jokes are kind of the interface between all that sort of stuff, which is why I use them a lot in my own book. But I decided again, one day I will write a book about these guys during the Troubles, the way they talk, their language, their attitudes, everything like that, because I wanted to memorialise that as well. So these are the two moments that really inspired me, and it was really to become a writer, but it was really to do with gratitude for what the experience that I had been gifted.
Mm. And how does that performative sort of element of storytelling and speaking vocally, how does that sort of translate into writing, or does it translate at all? That like you mentioned, there's people sort of retelling the same story but trying to improve it, trying to outdo each other in the performance. When you come to writing, is there an element of that performance? Are you sort of writing and then rewriting the same thing again to try and pull out a better performance from the piece, or do you kind of approach writing in a different way than the sort of storytelling?
Well, I mean, I don't rewrite that often, to be honest with you. So my books are not those sort of palm sets of again and again and again and again and again. It's not really kind of how I work, but the performing of a story, yes, I definitely think so. I think that I think my novels are fairly experimental, but they're not like experimental writ large. You know, you can read them as a non-experimental novel and get a hell of a lot out of them. But if you want to approach it in terms of modernism or things like that, the 20th century modernism, which I'm still in love with, you can get there as well. And one of the techniques that I use for that is performing, as my uncles and my father would do, where a book like For the Good Times, which is the one that's set during the Troubles, a book like that, I used many different ways of telling in there. For instance, I interrupt the text with jokes. I'll jump to a thing which is just like a Q&A, you know, just like some of the characters quizzing each other back and forth. I'll jump to another section which is much more impressionistic, or, you know, they take LSD and go to see The Clash. So then I go into a sort of much more impressionistic flowing sort of text thing there as well. So it's just all these different ways of telling and performing. And interestingly, in my new book, Extabeth, I've kind of pushed that even further, because I'm trying to get to this realm where the text becomes like music, where the book itself sings somehow, or where the book performs the story for you. And in Extabeth, what I've done as well is I've actually put like guitar chords at points suggested, because what you can do is you can accompany the book if you want. You can sing the book itself. You can imagine the music of it and those sort of things. So I wanted there to be many different ways to sort of enter into the universe of the book, which is, again, I've been doing right back from This Is Memorial Device, which was a novel, which was like oral history with lots of different voices, but then it had things like an index, it had multiple appendices. It could actually be read in any order. It was actually means you could drop in at any point. Every chapter sort of self-contained. You can read it backwards, starting from the index right to the front, and you'll find out different things, because some of the things are only revealed in the index, but if you knew them that direction, the story takes a slightly different twist. So I liked having these multiple entrance points to books as well, and I think that definitely comes from the idea of performing. And also, for me, books are organisms. Books are entities. If you do them well, if you code them precisely, they do take on a life. They do seem to have some kind of a life of their own. So that's something I'm very interested in as well, in how we can bring books alive. I've always been in love with that idea of the golem. You know, the Jewish idea of the golem, which is you build this thing from clay, but the way you bring it to life is you inscribe letters on the back of its neck, you know? So I love that idea that your somehow letters bring something to life. It's another idea that you get from Burroughs a little bit as well, that books are almost kind of like sentient, that they're like organisms. And my experience has certainly been that, because in another way, although I'm talking about how I like to perform or what I think, a lot of these are rationalizations after the books happen, because I never, ever go into a book with an idea, like ever. So Memorial Device, I knew I was going to write about Yerdry. For the Good Things, I knew I was going to write about Troubles. Beyond that, I didn't allow myself to have any ideas, and I never take notes. I never allow myself to take notes. If I am ever even out during the day and I get an idea for a book or a sentence or something that I'm working on, I immediately banish it. I don't even allow myself to take it serious or even engage with it, because I doubt these things when they come to me at first. And I say, well, you have to prove yourself. You know, this might not be the voice of the book speaking. This could be some kind of demon. You know what I mean? Or this just could be just my subconscious bullshit. So, you know, so I'm like, out. And I'm like, if you're still there or you rise again when I'm sitting working on that book, then I've weighed you correctly and I can use you in the book. But outside of that, I don't allow anything to come into me at all costs. And I don't allow myself to even think of ideas of the book, because then I feel as if my experience is much closer to dictation, to transcription, to channeling, than it is to anything else. And over the years, I know how to... It's a really hard thing to describe, because it's what triggers do I use to get myself into a certain receptive state where voices seem to be transmitting in a strong way. It's very hard for me to describe how I actually do that. But
do you have a particular time that you like to write, or a particular length of time that you spend writing in a day?
No, it's very much according to the project and what demands I feel the project is making on me to style a book. I've written at all times of the day or night. At the moment, during lockdown, I've somehow found myself writing in the evenings. I tend to do like admin or farting about stuff during the day. And then, I mean, when I do have a routine, I have a pretty strict routine. Right, for the moment, what happens is 6:30, I take a bath. I get out of the bath at 7. I crack open my beer, maybe get a wee mezcal or something like that. I come through here, I light a candle on my desk to ritualize it. I've got all my stuff around me, and I start writing on my novel without allowing myself to have a single thought. Or what I'll maybe do is I'll sit and have a drink. I'll sit a little bit. I'll try to get myself into this zone. It's very hard to describe how I get into it. And once I feel that I'm there and I receive a line or a voice that sounds authentic, I note it down. And after that sort of happens, it starts to gain its own momentum at that point. Once I've caught the voice a little bit, and I'll chase it for as long as I feel it's speaking. And I always get to have this thing where if I feel like I'm squeezing my brain too hard, then I stop. You know, I don't squeeze my brain. I do not force prose out ever. You know, I'll cut and run if I feel like I'm forcing that at any point. But this can mean that I'm less athletic, I think. I think when I was as a younger writer, when I was trying to learn how to write, I had a very athletic approach. I was determined that, you know, I would write 5-6 hours straight or something like that. You know, I'll write a book in 6 months, this kind of style. And I did that for a long time. And I don't really feel, it's much more sort of a crab-like now. You know, you sort of go to the side, you write your little bit surreptitiously without anyone really noticing you. And the next thing you know, you're back staring out the window. Nobody would even notice that you were working. I kind of like tricking my own subconscious without even telling myself that I'm doing this sort of stuff, which is why I don't allow myself to think about it when I write it. But then other times, like I wrote a book called Monument Maker. I was in France for a little bit. And then I would get up in it was a very different book. Then I would get up in the morning and I would make myself a coffee and I would write till like the afternoon, then take the rest of the day off. But now I'm not so out to prove my sort of athleticism anymore. You know what I mean? I'm just quite happy to grab time now and then. And I've found under lockdown, I've actually been writing a lot less, which is kind of pretty nice actually, because, you know, I think that Rimbaud is one of the greatest artists because, like, he cured himself of art. He cured himself of art at such a fucking early age, man, and he walked off into life. And, you know, I have this great ambition that I would like to do the same. I would like to cure myself of literature and, like, you know, and step through the page and back into my own life, because I think art should be like the sort of frame that you step through and into your own life more truer, deeper. It allows you to step through there. You know, it's like that frame on that photograph, turn that frame onto like what's right in front of you constantly and step out into life. But I want to use... Well, I owe the universe gratitude, so I had to write those first two books. But now it's like, it is like demons. There's no rest. You can't stop. That's why when I get a stray thought and I'm not working, I need to say, listen, mate, demon, voice, whatever, stop. I'm not interested in you. You have your time to speak, but until then, you've got no time to do it. So I have this vague sort of dream that one day I'll just be like, cured myself of literature. I've done it. You know, I'm out the other side and I've walked through one of my own books. But... And that's been what's been good about lockdown is I have watched myself definitely slow down as a writer, maybe give myself permission not to be writing all the time, which I'm really quite enjoying. And I'm hoping that one day it may let me go completely, but I don't know.
And do you think could part of that be that, particularly with the first two published novels, as you say, you had that sort of debt of gratitude to Adrian, and I guess for The Good Times is a lot about your sort of father's background. Now that you've worked through them, are you sort of surprised that there are other motivations coming to the fore about the stories that you want to tell, like with Exeter Birth?
Yes, massively so. They're different books. I mean, if you like my writing, you'll recognise that as one of my books. But at the same time, I feel Exeter Birth is inexplicable to me. I can understand where those first two books came from because I articulated it to you guys and I felt that from a young age. But something like Exeter Birth, well, I could never have planned to write Exeter Birth. I'm not 100% sure of everything in it myself. I'm still figuring it out. I don't think I'll ever get to the bottom of it, actually, which is what I love, because I really love things like William Blake, things like fathomless art, you know, art that is not there to be solved. You know, I'm not interested in solving any whatsoever, you know, or even necessarily having a point. What I find pretty interesting when I go, I've been on a few book award panels at this point, and it's very rare that anyone actually talks about prose. It's very rare that anyone talks about your writing style. It's very rare that anyone asks you about your rhythms, your use of structure, how you twist lines. People never ask you that. They always ask you what your book's about. And I find it very hard to say my book's about, because I'm going to say, well, what the fuck is life about? I would like to say my books don't have a single point. They're like experiences more than anything else, you know? There's not a point to them. And I often think, if you can sum your book up in a point, write a fucking essay, mate, and save us all from fiction, you know what I mean?
A sentence. If you can sum it up in a sentence, that's a good sentence.
Let's leave it at that. You know, well done, mate.
I think that's a very good point. And I think, you know, that's like one of the reasons we wanted to start this podcast is to talk about, to try and get behind the writing from a different way than that sort of standard approach of what's it about, presuming that a novel length piece of work is going to have a single thing it is about.
But often it does. I mean, many modern works of fiction do have a point and are written to make a point. And that kind of always blows my mind, you know? And I'm definitely writing pointlessly. One of the things that's really, really, really overrated and really gets up my crack these days is the idea of stories. Everyone's telling their story. We need more stories. Blah, 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 blah. Who gives a fuck about stories? It's how you tell them. I don't care what your story is. How can you deliver it? In a way, I don't care what the content of your story is, but I care in the style in which you deliver it. So, regardless of what the content is, if you can deliver it in a way that catches me completely and dazzles me and gives me that experience of awe at what art can do, at how you can transmit your experience as in a real way to another person, you can transfer these objects through time and space. If you have that magical facility with prose, I'm reading it, no matter what your story is.
Do you find you ever have to sort of disentangle those two, like the element of story, or I guess plot you're kind of talking about broadly, and the style and the delivery? Do you sort of ever sort of sit down and start writing something, and you think, yeah, the story here is good, but the delivery is not right, and you know, you then come back to almost retelling that same story with a different voice at some point in the future and think, okay, now this time I've nailed it? Or is it, if the story's not working, if the voice or the style is not working, you wouldn't really come back and revisit that same story again?
I mean, it's never really happened to me. I mean, I think my whole thing is form and content need to be absolutely inextricable. They need to be absolutely inextricable. They need to be reinforcing the same thing constantly. So I won't proceed with a novel until I've got the first sentence exactly in terms of form and content, and where I understand the voice and I think the voice matches what's going on. But then sometimes these voices will be inexplicable. As with Extabeth, I began writing Extabeth. I can't really remember writing Extabeth, if I'm being honest with you. I genuinely can't remember writing parts of that book. And when I read it back, I was quite amazed myself. It was like discovering a book that I hadn't written, that somehow had been written through me or something like that. It was a very, very sort of very uncanny feeling. But I didn't really know what that book was doing. I genuinely did not know what it was doing, but I knew that the form and content were somehow right. They were inextricable. The voice was convincing. It was taking me somewhere I didn't really know I was going, but I was completely persuaded by it. So I don't tend to fart about too much with like ideas that don't work. You know what I mean? I mean, if I'm getting to
You don't find that like with Memorial Device, for instance, there's a lot of different voices there. When you came to editing that, it wasn't a process of sort of weeding out, you know, half as much content again to get down to the good stuff. The stuff that you had were just the voices that had struck you as being honest and correct the first time.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of voices never made it in the end to the final. There's a couple other chapters in there that I just thought were maybe egging it a little bit too much and left it a little bit more mysterious by removing them. So I removed a couple of voices in the end. I think in terms of an edit on that, I worked very closely with my editor, Lee Brackstone. I mean, we're very good friends as well as being very close collaborators. And he has an approach very similar. And mine, I always say the thing about Lee is that he can, as an editor, he can read a book's mind. I mean, it's uncanny. He will come up with these suggestions and I'll often be like, what? And then I'll follow through with trusting him and I'll be like, fucking hell. You know, like, off the top of my head, there's a section for The Good Times where Tommy and Barney or Sammy, whatever. Tommy and Barney, as it go to Glasgow. They have to go on the run for a little bit because they're getting some heat after trying to blow up the Europa Hotel. And they go to Glasgow. And Lee, when he read the manuscript, just went, mate, why don't they nap down to Kentish Town? Well, they're here. There's a really big Irish population down there. And I was like, Well, all right. And then I remembered meeting some Republicans one night who claimed to know my dad in a pool hall in Kennystown. So I began to think maybe there's something in that. So then I sat down to write this fucking piece, sat down in Kennystown, and it just went completely out of control. And it became the absolute centre and core of the book. Of course, it didn't evolve in the way that you think it might, whether I just had to have more adventures in Kennystown. They end up in this fucking psychedelic torture pseudo dungeon run by some kind of initiatory inner order of the IRA, you know, and I saw the book had been going there, and we had just spotted it in the centre. It was just missing this one thing. It was a complete revelation. And Memorial Device was kind of the same. Lee, the thing, I've never worked for another editor, so I don't know how other editors work. I think maybe I'm spoiled, but Lee is never the sort of editor to rein you in. Lee is never the sort of guy to say, like, tidy that up, or, like, you need to cut that, or I think you can be more concise. Lee is always, like, push it harder. I think you could push it harder. And one of the things I guess he said to me with Memorial Device, which was very good, was he was like, push the voices harder. Push the individual voices harder. So I just went back and I sort of amplified the characteristics a little bit. And what that began, and what I really enjoyed with that is I got into using things like weird syntax and punctuation. I really like that on the page. You know, I like a bit of concrete poetry and shit all that as well. I just like how it looks. And I began to realize that you can use these sort of concrete techniques almost, but you can make them read. You can use them as if you're using them just to give the rhythms of speech, but they can also be interpreted as a weird concrete building, as a weird sort of structural frame or a grid around the actual prose itself. So again, I like that sort of line between, you know, just vernacular and modernism, you know?
Do you think, because particularly with the first book, Memorial Device, it's sort of set within the music scene. I wanted to ask you about your sort of previous work, maybe ongoing work, writing music journalism. And how there's kind of a performative element to that a bit as well. I mean, I'm sure, like, as the writer, you're not trying to draw too much attention to yourself, but there's definitely something to be said for getting very distinctive voices when you're writing music journalism. So do you think that was a good practice for sort of setting you up to explore language in that way?
Yes, my best apprenticeship ever, I think. I think writing music criticism is kind of like writing science fiction or something like that. But you're trying to describe something that's kind of ineffable. It's trying to describe something that's fantastic. You're trying to describe something on this incredible scale. And you're trying to do it in language. You're trying to make words. I probably liked rock criticism as much as I liked rock music. In fact, sometimes I liked even the writing about it better than the actual music. Sometimes you would read it, like Lester Bangs. When I read Lester Bangs, I mean, I fucking loved it. Got Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, 1988 or something. And I mean, that book, I don't know how many times I've read that book. And I probably like that book as much as I like all my favourite records as well, because the thing I liked about Bangs and the thing that I tried, I don't write music journalism anymore, by the way. I haven't done it for about 5 years. I did it for 25 years and I'm like, enough at this point. You know, I like going back to being a fan now and just enjoying music. But the thing that I loved about Lester Bangs, that was a big influence on me, was that his prose was the equal of the music. It didn't betray it in any way. It wasn't the sort of like interpretation of it. It was a presentation of that music's energy as prose. You know, it was literally reflecting that energy. And I absolutely loved that. And early on, I thought, you can do that. You can transmit energy with words. Well, I mean, you can. And this is what the greatest poetry does as well. I mean, this is when I was talking about literally you get to the art. The art of literature is a form of magic, because you are literally transmitting objects, times, and people through time and space. And you can feel it manifest in front of you. You know, then that's what I mean by that. I had this feeling of it being alive. I think this is the magic of it. And I first got that feeling of prose being alive, definitely from my favorite rock writers. I was like, this is just so fucking alive, and especially the energy. I really like energy. I like what am I looking for? This feeling of rushing headlong, or being driven headlong. This sort of amphetamine kind of rush, this kind of energy. That's what I love in all my books. I want my books to be. I don't stop for boring descriptions. You know what I mean? I don't stop to describe what a guy looks like. If we're caught up in this momentum, we don't have time. We're unfolding. I'm not going to stop and mention the weather or something like that. You know what I mean? So I like this constant kind of snowballing, and I definitely got that from rock criticism, but also from interviewing so many people. I mean, I've hundreds of hours of cassettes I transcribed over my lifetime with different musicians, and you really get into how people speak. You really get into the how people's personalities are reflected in the rhythms of how they speak, how they move, how they act. And that's a brilliant thing for a writer as well, especially when you have to transcribe it. And I was obsessive. I would transcribe every single word, every hum and haw, and I would use syntax to kind of capture, you know, I'd have blank spaces, gaps, empty brackets. I love that sort of shit. I love empty brackets. Mm. I love empty brackets because it's like you're literally making ingress into a book. You know, I think I've used this form of brackets in almost every one of my novels at some point, because I also think that there's a literary subterranean that every writer has across his whole catalogue. And I believe that there are access and entrance points between all of these different books. You know, there are certain words, there are trails of words, there are certain phrases, there are certain ideas, there are certain conversations that happen in every one of my books, subtly but quite deliberately, to the point where you might not notice them. But I like to think these are the wormholes that allow ingress between all the worlds of my books, you know? Mm. And all these ideas came from music journalism, really, for me.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, transcribing sort of spoken interviews must be an amazing sort of apprenticeship for getting the rhythm of them.
I mean, tedious. It's tedious as hell as well. I mean, I'm such a slow typer. And so sometimes you'd be like, you know, you'd spend an entire weekend, 6 to 8 hours a day, just listening to some person's voice and typing. And I always hated it when I was doing it, but now I think, wow, that was quite amazing, actually, you know?
Is it quite a similar process? Are you talking about sort of waiting for the voice to arrive to you almost? Does it feel a similar process to transcribing when you do sit down and the voice is there, that you're almost transcribing it from a cassette in your head when you're writing? Or is it quite a different process to...
That's a very good point. Actually, I hadn't actually put two and two together there with that, but that's completely accurate. It does feel like I'm dictating from a tape, and I'm doing the same thing. I'm listening so closely because I want to see how this voice speaks, and not just the words it uses. I want to see how it mixes up syntax sometimes when it delivers stuff. I want to accurately map its gaps and blanks. I want to catch its rhythm, its stuttering, its start and stops and things like this, you know? And it's just...
Do you read out your text at all? Would that be once you've kind of completed a section, or once you've got a draft of the whole novel, or at the end of a day's or evening's writing, or...
Constantly. I don't think there's a day goes by where I don't read out a part of what I'm working on, you know? It's absolutely vital. It's absolutely vital. I just can't stand a fucking clumsy sentence, man. And I don't mean that like, you know, I like a rhythmic sentence, but like I like odd rhythms. I like avant-garde music and I like experimental literature, but I still love the rhythms of them as well. But I just can't stand a clumsy, ugly sentence. I couldn't have it in a book. Everything has to flow. It's what I mean is there should be no obstruction whatsoever between that one sentence and the next, one section and the next. You know, there should never be a stopping, a pausing, or even a lessening of interest. And I mean that for me, because I would get bored. I can't, as I said, I'm not going to sit around and describe the weather. I just don't care. I'm not going to set the scene. You know, I'm not going to say, the scene has started. The scene is here. I'm not saying that this is it. You know, I'm never talking about it. I'm always trying to be it. We're not building up to it. We're experiencing it. This is a constant thing for me, you know?
Hey, what you reading for?
This is where the benefit of reading comes into play.
Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
And in terms of you said earlier that you need to sort of sit down, have a beer, you know, light a candle and stuff, get into the right mood for it. Do you then reread what you had previously written the session before, or do you just go cold into it? You've sort of remembered enough of what was there already.
Half and half, I would say, half and half. Sometimes if the voice is really strong, I sit down, I have a drink, and I just immediately feel an overwhelming, whoop, here we go. Then I'll just have to disregard what went before because the voice is so strong, I'm not going to let anything else colour it. But sometimes I'll sit down and I try not to squeeze my brain, so I don't immediately sit down and say, get this voice coming, we're working here. So sometimes I will just sit down and maybe something's not coming immediately. So then what I will do is I'll go and read the previous section, and I'll read it aloud, and I'll get the rhythm, bam, 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 bam. And I'll try to decide, is there more to be said in this rhythm? Is this section is this section said all it has to be said, or are we still here or not? And I'll just go entirely with feel with the next sentence that comes up, whether I'm going to continue with this or whether we're moving somewhere else, or whether we're moving somewhere else really radically. I'm writing this book at the moment called Industry of Magic and Light. And it sort of started off, well, here, yeah, let me talk about characters a little bit as well, because, you know, sure. I can't make my characters perform at will. I can't do it. I've always had this thing where, you know how they teach you, like, even if your character doesn't understand their motivation, then the author should. I mean, I think that's absolute madness. I think it's absolute madness. If you understand the motivation of all your characters, all you are is a puppet master. You're just a puppet master. These people are no longer real. They're no longer real. So I only know, like, my characters and Memorial Device. I only know as much about them as anyone else did. If I wanted to find it anymore, I would have to write about it. And there's a character in Memorial Device called Mary Hannah. She's a secret hero of the book. Everyone's crushed out on her, including me. I'm totally crushed out on her. She played bass with Memorial Device in their sort of later incarnation. She's an artist. Now, I would love to be with these characters again. I've lived with them for years. Patty, Memorial Device, Mary, all these people. And I feel genuinely affectionate about them. I love them. They were real to me, and I was so touched watching their stories unfurl. And if I wanted to find out what they were doing now, I'd have to write it. But I can't trust that they would even turn up in anything that I wrote. I can't trust that. But then I had the most beautiful experience. I was writing a book called Monument Maker, which is probably going to be my next novel. This is the one I was writing in France in the mornings. It's kind of a lot of it's about, I'm very interested in Gothic architecture and Romanesque sculpture and religious art. It's a big book. It's a big book. It's a quarter of a million words. It's fiction, but it's a lot of it's about religious art, stonemasonry. Part of it's set during the fall of Khartoum. Part of it's set, you know, lead up to the Second World War. It's probably the most ambitious thing that I've ever done. But it ranges across the way. And at one point, a guy is visiting this person who's a secret sculptor, in a garage somewhere. And I'm writing the scene as it unfolds. I'm like, all right, okay, he's visiting this sculptor, let's see what happens. So he opens the door of the garage to walk in and see this secret sculptor. And I'm not kidding. I look in there at this garage that he's just opened as I'm writing it, and it's fucking Mary Hannah. It's Mary Hannah who's the sculptor. And I was like, of course it's fucking Mary Hannah. She's a secret sculptor. This is a garage at Yeardry. And honestly, I wept. I was so, so moved to see Mary again after years. And it was a younger Mary. It was before she was in Memorial Device, while she was still working her sculptures, living at her mum's house. Her mum had died. She was living at her mum's house and making sculpture in her garage. And I was so moved. I was like, oh my God, Mary Hannah's here. I'm going to get to spend time with Mary Hannah. And I was so psyched. And of course, typical fucking Mary Hannah, 5,000 words later, she fucks off and disappears. And I never see her again for the rest of the book. And I was like, it's so Mary Hannah. But it's real. It proves to me it's real. She was real. She acted totally like Mary Hannah. I was so moved to see her, and she fucked off again and got back to her own art. That to me is kind of these mind-blowing experiences that you have with your characters, you know.
And would you ever come back to, like, say that thought or that image occurred to you while you're at the shop in the afternoon, when you come back to in the evening to sit down and write, would you start to sort of, oh, no, I remember this again, it's obviously not the voice of a demon, it's something worth pursuing? Would you make any notes at that point when you're sort of sitting down preparing to write, like, oh, maybe this could work in, or just remember it and then see where the story goes?
Well, let me say, I don't think all demons are, I think some things there are demons that are worth listening and following. I mean, there's infernal influences as well as angelic influences, and I think they're both quite vital, and I like to balance them both in both books in order. I think we need the two hands of God in order to create anything that's, you know, that feels alive. But no, as I say, I would never ever allow myself to take a note. So I would never come in and note that down or when I start, or even allow myself to have an idea. But if I wait and it's still present, then yes. Hmm. Something like Mary Hannah, I mean, I could never have thought that up. But if I had thought I'm going to stick Mary Hannah in a book, I'd have felt pretty bad about it, because you don't just fucking stick Mary Hannah in a book. You know what I mean? That's just treating your cat. That's back to puppet master shit again. And I'm really not into that.
But maybe something a bit more, you know, you have an idea of a sort of minor plot point, something minor that you think, oh, that could work, and then it occurs to you again later on, you think, okay, maybe there is something to this. You wouldn't write any notes down or a reminder to yourself when you're sat in front of the page again.
No. I would have to absolutely trust in my subconscious, and I trust the dictates of the voice above, beyond anything that I would consciously bring. Yeah. I try not to consciously bring anything. And sometimes I think I'm cheating when I get something like that. Sometimes I'll sit down at night and I'm like, well, there's a structural idea occurring to me here. But I'm like, don't cheat. That's a get-out clause. You're not even listening anymore. You're just forcing this fucking idea you've got on just to fill up words at this point or to make the book more coherent. And part of the fun is seeing where the book ends up. For instance, the book that I'm working on at the moment, well, and again, I would never thought that I would ever self-consciously re-enter the world of Memorial Device again, even though Mary Hannes turned up in a separate book. But one night I was writing and I began writing a story and I realised it was a bunch of guys who ran a psychedelic light show. You know, like they're using the gels and the projection screens and stuff like that. And the name came to me immediately, Industry of Magic and Light. And so, like, I'll keep writing. Then I realised it was set in Airdrie in the 1960s as I was writing. Then I realised that one character from Memorial Device was actually in this book, was one of the main characters, a guy called Teddy Ohm, who's an older biker and a record collector. Well, he is old enough to have been in Airdrie in the 1960s. So then I was like, holy fuck, this is like a prequel to This Is Memorial Device. And so it kind of had that feel for a little bit, but then it just fucked off on its own trajectory completely, and it ended up with a detective that becomes a detective story. There's a detective's wife has died, and he believes that he gets in touch with his light show operators because he believes through a combination of perhaps psychedelics, magic, and lights, there's a way to revivify the dead somehow. And then there's a section narrated by a boxer in a coma who then tells the story of another character by reading their tarot cards. And I'm like, where the fuck is all this coming from? This could have been a straightforward Memorial Device prequel, mate. You know what I mean? But again, I think if I'd structurally said, this is what that's going to be, it would have been so much less, you know? And so we were talking about performance. You've got to remember not to perform yourself too much. You know, you can become David Keenan. You can become the writer. And I think that's why I avoid ideas or even notes, because I think my conscious ideas of myself would be too fixed as to who David Keenan is and would not perhaps allow me to write other books like Extabeth, like Industry of Magic and Light, which I don't recognise as me. I don't recognise those books as me. Again, we're going back to the unfathomable thing. I don't think I'll ever get to the bottom of those books or why they had to be written. But sometimes I think is the universe just rewarding attention, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said as well for your feelings about how it could have been a prequel to Memorial Device, but the feeling that you have that it has to be alive and it has to be interesting to you. I think as much as that's not a kind of really rational way of going about things, that's just a really good guide, isn't it? If it just feels dead, if it feels boring, then you'll always, that's a good guide to you that you can always rely on. And I think it takes some kind of courage to be completely instinctive about it. But I think you're generally going to get stuff that just feels like it's got integrity from doing that.
I think I always think the two qualities that I like the most in art, and I think it's something I think of myself as maybe as a religious writer. I definitely have a huge religious impulse, although I'm not traditionally religious in those ways. I am religious. And I think the key tenets of religion are not any kind of like behavioural or moral codes or anything like that. I think they're faith and awe. I think what religious art should do, I talk about this all the Monument Maker, and I think what art has done for me, what magic has done for me, what religion has done for me, what art has done for me, has to develop a facility, awe, absolute awe at how magical and insane the world is, how it will always keep, reality will always outstrip fiction, always. It's fucking much more weirder, fiction, just trying to keep up with it. And just this attitude of awe for the incredible gift of experience, even the difficulties as well. But also faith. Now, I have faith, and I don't have faith in anything because I don't believe. I have faith. I think if you say you believe, I think you're faithless. You're holding on to something. You're holding on to an idea. That's not faith. If you have faith, why do you need an idea? I have faith in nothing, but I have complete faith in it. And I've come to faith through religion and art and magic and literature, but through writing, because writing has taught me to have faith. And I think it's daring and it's frightening when you enter on writing these books, and it's like a tightrope with no safety net whatsoever. You're trusting all these voices in your head, but the greatest thing you can learn as an author, as a writer, I believe, is faith. Faith that the voices will come. Faith that if you're honest to them, that you do not try to corrupt them, twist them, or force them through your own matrix in any way, they will come. I rely on them, and they come every night for me now, you know, and I have the faith that allows that. Jack Spicer, the poet, is a massive influence on me. I absolutely love Jack Spicer. And Jack Spicer talks about trying to write. He talked about receiving. I feel very close to his working method because he also talked about receiving things. He talked about it was like on a dial of a radio, and you're trying to pick up signals, and you're dialing through, and you're trying to hear the voice clearly. And he also described that as like the messages are coming through, but it's as if there's a Martian in the room, and all he's got is building blocks with the letters of the alphabet on it to try to communicate what he's trying to communicate, you know? And what he's trying to say is get yourself out of the way as much as possible to let it come through. And that's a statement of faith for me. Faith that these...
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Like the idea of faith, I think that is, yeah, really important to get a piece finished, to get the words onto the page. You have to have faith that they're coming from somewhere... with that, you're transmitting that energy that we're talking about from somewhere positive. And I guess a lot of writers, like, it's quite easy to lose faith. And I think that's where a lot of the kind of plot point structural frameworks for novels, you know, people can then sort of fall back on, oh, well, this is not going anywhere very fast. What I need to do is read a book on how to write a book, or yeah, I need to come up with some kind of framework for it. Which, and I mean, I guess the different styles of writing, sometimes a framework does lend itself to sort of channeling the voice, I guess. But I mean, without having any of that framework, how do you move forward when you've, I imagine I have moments where you sort of not lost faith entirely, but you're finding it harder to have faith, like when it's flowing as easily. How do you keep the momentum or keep the faith alive and keep going?
I just know there's always times where you sort of feel like it's falling. I mean, you are traveling without a map completely. You don't know where you're going to end up, and but it's always come through. It's always come through. And then even at points where I'm like, holy fuck, what the fuck is this? Where the hell are we going now? I mean, I was like, this really? You know? And then maybe a couple of days later, I'll be like, holy fuck, I could never, ever have got here rationally. I could never have thought this through. And no wonder I was doubting my faith a couple of days ago, because there's no way I could have actually sat down and thought this. And that has happened to me so many times that when I see myself going off in the mad wormhole, I'm just like, here we go. See what happens here. Where are we going to end up? And I feel the excitement. And I'm like, whoa, this could destabilize the book a little bit. But it fucking never does. It never does if you follow through. I think if I panicked, I think if I shat myself a little bit, if I was like, whoa, don't know about this. If I wobbled, I think, you know, what's that saying? If you're sitting, if you're walking, above all, don't wobble. That's the thing in writing. Don't wobble. Don't wobble. And if you are starting wobbling, stop. Walk away. Get back and don't wobble, because you are on this tightrope. You know, I never do any structural planning, ever. I've never sat down with a plan, and I've never written out, you know, like, how everything relates, too much, blah, 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 anything like that. And I also avoid research. I avoid doing research, because one of my maxims is that research is an excuse for not inventing, you know? And once your book's written, you can maybe, like, okay, when I was writing for The Good Times, I mean, that was quite a daring book to not research. But you know what? I grew up with that, and I thought my memory of that reality is as valid as any other way of going through those historical times. You know, people always want you to write things in very broad brush strokes. They want the big cliches, you know, they want the big events, but history is not lived out on these big events where people, that's not how people live. And I'm always interested in books that are much more micro histories. How did actual human beings living through this historical time, how did it affect them? But in order to get to that, I thought, I'm not researching this fucking book. I'm not researching it. I'm going purely on feel. Purely on feel. And at the end, you get a copy editor who'll check a couple of facts for you so you don't make any massive fuck-ups. But I thought it was pretty interesting, because sometimes I think fiction gets closer to the truth of what happened than any dry, objective, non-fiction account. Somehow. You know, I think somehow it gets closer to it, to how it actually feels. You know, what time I actually felt inside your mind, inside your brain, as these things were unraveling. And I was pretty pleased before the how the good times came out, because I did a launch night with Bill Drummond at the London Review Bookshop, and he had a friend who was a policeman. I don't know if he was a member of RUC or whatever that, but he was a policeman in Belfast, maybe even been Secret Service. And he asked Bill Drummond to ask me if I had ever served in the Northern Ireland Police Force. And I was like, fuck me. My lack of research went pretty well there. I wanted to moan at something, do you know what I mean? And I was like, wow, you got to trust these voices, man, you know? And even when I was writing that book, the spectre of like Bobby Sands, was, at one point, I think he was literally hanging over the book. And he was there. But I didn't know how much I was going to approach any of this, whether I was going to touch on these big things or not. And I just trusted the book to take me where it would take me. And in the end, Bobby Sands is kind of like a figure very much in the background of the book. I didn't know that was going to happen until I'd written it, you know? Mm.
And does that approach to research also go for the 250,000 long page one that you've got coming up that had all the stuff about Gothic architecture and various points of history in it?
Yeah, well, you know, I've developed a fascination with that kind of architecture in these books. And I guess for a few years, I was collecting books on it. I was just reading it because, well, these are old books about like cathedrals and things like this, and there's an amazing book that Faber and Faber published in the 1970s, and it just would never get fucking published now. It's called Incised Effigial Slabs. And it is a two-volume artifact set in a slipcase. Where this eccentric guy went around Europe finding all these incised effigial slabs and documenting them. And this is one of the books that kind of got me obsessed. One, because I just like weird, I'm a bibliophile. I like eccentric publishing and shit like that. I like eccentric authors. And I fell in love with Faber and Faber. And I was on the same label, publisher. I was on Faber and Faber, the same fucking people that released this shit. I was like, this is amazing, you know? So then I began just chasing down eccentric architecture books. I got a book by this woman called Joan Evans, which is monastic architecture in France. It's fucking so beautiful. It's amazing. So I just stare. It just makes me feel good. It's kind of my chill space when I sit down and I look through pictures of monastic architecture, and just the fact that these eccentric people existed and wrote these fucking mad books, and big publishers published them in deluxe editions once upon a time. I just love that culture. So I think I'd osmosed a lot of that without actually thinking I was researching, because I didn't intend to write a book about this shit. But then I did. Then I began writing and I realised, fucking hell, this is an eccentric architect talking about cathedrals. But then this is how weird things fall into place. So then someone pointed out to me, there's a Robert Louis Stevenson Fellowship that you can apply for, and you go to a town called Grasse or Loire, which is south of the Forest of Fontainebleau. It's where, and you stay in a Hotel Cherbion, which is a place where August Strindberg lived, and Robert Louis Stevenson met his wife there. There's a lot of the composer D-Way's lived along the road. Fucking beautiful, tiny little French village. So I realised that some of the cathedrals that I was writing about were within cycling range of where that fellowship was. And I was like, this is fucking mental. So I applied for the fellowship and fucking got it. So next thing I know, I'm actually in the area that the book that I began writing was set in. So I was writing the book actually in situ in the book. So what I would do each day was I would just say what was going to happen in the book was whatever happened to me that day. I don't mean literally, but if I went to a certain cathedral, like I went to this place called Lachant, Basilica of Lachant, absolutely stunning place, then that basilica is in the book, you know? But it just felt like I was being gifted with all these things because the book wanted to happen, you know? It's quite amazing. And then just weird things happen. It's the best set in Russia. Don't know... It just is. It told me it was set in Russia. Never been to Russia. Didn't research Russia. Just remembered it from all my fanboy Russian literature that I like and references and shit with that. Trusted that Extabeth and Anna Leia knew what they were doing when they were talking to me. And after I'd finished it, I got an invite to go to Russia. And I got to go to... I spent like a week at Tolstoy's estate. Did a DJ set in Tolstoy's front garden, by the way, which is quite fucking surreal. went to Chekhov's estate, hung out in Moscow. Still, I mean, it's just amazing, just these incredible gifts. You know, I still write in gratitude, and I'm gifted these incredible experiences. Whenever I'm working on a book, something in my life is transformed by and relates to that book. It's really quite incredible, you know?
Yeah, it all sort of ties together as well, and comes together, yeah.
It does, it's uncanny. It's really, really uncanny. And that's my experience has been like magic. You know, I speak to other writers, and I don't hear a lot of writers talking about this. And I don't really understand why, because my experience is, honestly, there's been times where I have felt like I'm maybe close to being insane. And certainly, I think being a writer has definitely impacted on my mental health, definitely. And that's what I mean in terms of like feeling like you're kind of possessed. Well, I mean, one of the classic definitions of madness is having voices inside your head. Well, isn't that every fucking author? You know, and sometimes I've got like, when I was doing memorial debates, it was like fucking 50 voices, 50 different characters competing for attention. And it can really be overwhelming. In fact, parts of Monument Maker, and also I wrote this book called The Tomb of the Song at one point, which almost sent me insane. I really, really, really felt I was having a breakdown writing that book, to the point where I finished it, because I don't know finish things, but I abandoned it. I walked away, and I had parts that I don't ever want to read again. It was necessary for me to write, but all the books that I write are not necessary for me to publish. I mean, at this point, I've probably written about 10 novels, you know, that are, I mean, most of which are unpublished, and some of them I probably will never publish, you know? So you never really know what a book wants, you know, or if it even wants to be published or not. But I still have this thing where I'm writing hopelessly, so I'm not too concerned about it. I write completely without hope of achieving the book, of the book ending, of getting it right or getting it published. I just try to listen to the immediate demands of the book.
It must be quite tricky to decide, though, not to... I mean, if a book has really, really pushed your mental health, I can see that. But to make the decision about, like, well, yeah, this... I will pursue getting this published, but that one... I suppose you're not saying forever if you leave it on there.
No. I'm not. You just always have to feel what's right.
If you have, like, multiple projects on the go at the same time, do you kind of... have, if you sit down to write and have a voice coming that you think this is strong, this has got the energy that I'm wanting to transmit, but it's absolutely nothing to do with this book I'm writing about architecture, say, it's definitely got something to do with another project that I was working on last year, or do you tend to sort of work on one project at a time and the voices all kind of fit as they fit within that project, and once that's finished, you move on to the next one?
Not completely. I mean, I do tend to like long, extended focus sessions on one piece. I don't chop and change quickly. Like, I won't change writing on a book day to day. For instance, at the moment, I'm working on that book, Industry of Magic and Light. I'm writing on it every night. I'm feeling I'm on at the moment. I don't want to think about anything else, but I'm going to have to soon, because I'm moving on to the edit of Monument Maker, which will be coming out next summer. I'm going to have to change. But I'm holding off that to the last minute, because if I'm on Industry of Magic Light, it's important for me to stay with it while I'm on. But I will get to the point where I'll say, okay, that's a good stopping point. I'll move on to Monument Maker, and I'll come back again in a month, and I'll trust that I'll be able to pick it up again. I have got multiple books in the states of various completion. Even this year, I wrote a book called Conspiracy of Girls. Last year, I was in France quite a lot, so I keep going back to that area of France now. And I'd say I wrote about probably half the Conspiracy of Girls. But it seemed something particular to it. I've been working on it in France as well, and I was anticipating going back to France, but then the lockdown happened and I was unable to do it. So I've put Conspiracy of Girls on the back burner a little bit. But I have faith that when the time is right, I'll know it's right and I'll return to it again. Possibly not until I go back to France again. And there's other things in the back of my mind. Like, I wrote a memoir, and I really want this to come out. It's called I Am the Body of All the Conquistadors. And it's a little bit about... it's about my father. It's a little bit about mental health issues. It's a lot about Mexico and the conquistadors. I fell in love with Mexico completely and utterly. Memorial Device came out there, and for some reason it was a really big success in Mexico, which I understood when I went over there and saw how amazing the culture is, the DIY culture, how hungry they are for art and music. And I made so many friends there. I spent a lot of time in Central and South America over the past few years. But what happened is when I'll tell you the background to it. When this is Memorial Device was shortlisted for the Gordon Byrne Prize when it came out, and that was the first prize ceremony I'd ever really been to. And after Denise Mina won it that year. I won it the next year for the Good Times, though. But afterwards, me and some friends were partying pretty hard in the hotel room and blah blah blah. And my dad was born with a cowl, a lucky cap. You know, it's a skin that comes out of your head, and it's a film that forms around the baby, and it'll drown, and you have to burst it and get it out. But it's believed to be lucky, and it's believed that there was a trade that sailors would buy these things, because if you had a lucky cap, you couldn't drown, because you'd survive the waters of life intact in this little cocoon. It's a beautiful idea. So they used to sell them and stuff like that. If you're going to see, you would buy them on private advertisers in the newspaper to take on you. So when my dad died, he left me his lucky cap and he sewed it in a pouch that said D on it, like, so I could never drown. So anyway, we were in Durham. And the morning after, there was a lot of crazy shit going on, just too much to get there. Well, a lot of mad stuff. And I was feeling very, very fragile the next day, man, very fragile. And my dad hadn't died that long ago. And I was thinking a lot about my father getting shortlisted for an award with a novel, but with a father who was illiterate. I was thinking of all these things that morning. And talking about voices, didn't know why I did it at the time, but I did it anyway. As I was walking over the bridge.
You will notice that this is not David Keenan's voice. Ah, this is Jamie dropping in to say at this crucial point in David's story, the technological gods, perhaps in cahoots with his departed dad, decided to break our connection. So we missed that very, very vital element in which David explains that something in his head told him to throw the call into the water. So he was standing on the bridge, he took the bag with the D on it that his dad had given him, and he threw it into the water. Without that little element, this next bit wouldn't make sense. So I'll let David carry on with the story.
Inexplicable thing to do, and I was very shocked and upset myself, and I couldn't understand why I'd done it and why I'd listened to that voice. So why I believed that voice was saying something that I had to be actioned at all costs against even my better judgment. And so I was quite distraught and, I'd lost that piece of my father. But I remember thinking, well, you know, see your father out there in the world, now everywhere, you know. But then I had the revelation. I realised, wait a minute, but he can never drown. You know, I've thrown him in this fucking river, but he can never drown. And then I realised, well, in that case, my father is alive in every waterway in the world. Weirdly, straight after that, Memorial Device is coming out in Mexico, and I went to some literary book fairs over there, and I decided to stay away in Mexico. And I stayed in Mexico. Now, so I was flying over on the plane, looking down at the ocean. I realised, fucking hell, my father is alive down there. And then I realised, wow, my father has taken the same route as the conquistadors to Mexico. And in fact, he's gone on ahead of me. And so when I arrived in Mexico, I began to realise that, well, I need to visit every possible waterway that I can visit in Mexico City and Querétaro and Tijuana and all these places where I travelled around. So I just began going, I would ask friends or people, where's the nearest waterway? You know, whether it was a river, whether it was a lake, I took a boat out and I got a boat to get in a couple of lakes. But I would also go and look at the standing pails of dirty water next to the taco stands. I'd go to like this disgusting like sewers, like these rancid rivers. I would go all to these places and think my father is in there too. And I would just write about communing with my father in the waterways in Mexico. While also what I did was I was very interested in the conquistadors. And what I sometimes do is just a fun exercise most of the time, although it's ended up in some of my books, is that I translate foreign poetry or literature without knowing anything about the language. I allow myself to have a dictionary and have a rough idea of what it is, and I do my own translations. And sometimes I just listen to the voice and I start riffing and it becomes something totally different. Like I really love the poet Pierre Reverdy. And I translated a lot of his poems from French for Monument Maker. And I don't really know French, you know, but I was never happy with these translations. So what I began doing in Mexico was I was living with my Mexican editor, Eduardo Robasa, and had a wee rooftop apartment in his house. And at night I would be on my own because he was working a lot. I would get a little bottle of mezcal and I'd sit up there. And for fun, I'd get a candle and I would translate accounts of the conquistadors. But I began to translate them as if they were writing letters home to their dad, to tell them what they'd been up to in Mexico, just the same way that I was writing to my dad about what I was up to in Mexico. So this, and I had no idea this book was ever going to happen. I certainly didn't think I was ever going to write a sort of memoir type thing. But yet again, the universe gifted me with all these things. And even I began to understand why I'd been able to throw my dad's remains in the river. Again, it was another act of faith in a way. It was an act in faith that the universe would respond, that the reality of my father was out there, that you find yourself out there, not in ideas or relics at all. You know, so this became an amazing thing for me. And so I finished this book. I mean, it's called I Am the Body of All the Conquistadors. And I mean, I do want it to come out at some point. I don't know when it will. And again, it's the first thing I've done that's sort of like, I mean, it's still quite fictiony because I'm rewriting the conquistador stories still a little bit. But that's something that's more memoir-y that I never thought I would ever write either. But it's a question of like, at the time, I just felt impelled to understand my own actions. But I realized that action of the throwing away of the cow had initiated this entire thing. Initiated the entire thing. It's something about gifting something to the world and getting it back. That's a lesson that keeps repeating for me, because one of the things that I want to do with literature is I am interested in affirming. My whole thing is saying yes. Yes is the hardest thing to say. It's the hardest thing to say. It's really easy to have critiquey, whiny literature. I say, this is bad, this is rubbish, down with this sort of thing, blah, 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 that sort of crap. What about saying yes? What about standing up for how magic experience is? What about being grateful and thankful, not just for all the wonderful things, but all the difficult things too, all the tragic things, all the tough things? What about being grateful just for experience without judgment and still saying yes? That's what I try to do in all my books. Absolutely saying yes to all the difficulties, all the problems, and all the magic and wonder that come along with these things. Modernism was such a positive thing. How its kind of legacy has become like this kind of critique, or how language forms is, or how language is its power. But you know, when I read modernism, it was just completely liberating. It was just about the epiphanies of the moment, of the now, and the how you're always at the centre of the world, and how the epiphanies are possible anywhere. And I always think of the fucking end of Ulysses. You know, yes, yes, I will. Yes. I mean, ending, I get a shiver up my spine every time I remember that. One of the greatest works of modernism ends with yes, yes, yes. Yes, I will. Reaffirms existence. Fucking hell. That's magic, and that is the goal for me in my books, that degree of yes saying, you know.
So thank you to David for joining us, being very generous with your time. It's great to speak to him, and thank you to you for listening.
Yeah, if you liked what you hear, we've got 33 other episodes in the back catalogue, so do find us either online at our website at unsignedmethods.co.uk, or you can tweet us on Twitter at unsignedmethods.
Yeah, thanks. We love hearing from everyone. If you're interested in David's writing, you can find out more about him from the details we put in the episode notes here. And if you're interested in finding out about my writing, my website is jamiebatchin.com, at Jamie Batchin on Twitter, or at Jamie_Batchin on Instagram.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
We'll see you all later in the autumn.
See you.
Take it easy. Thanks for listening.